This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You are listening to The Morning Run. It's 6 a.m. on Monday, the 21st of March, the start of yet another work week. I'm Shazana Mokhtar in studio today with Tan Chun Lee and Wong Xiao Ning.
Good morning.
How was your weekend, everyone?
Pretty good, pretty good. I would say that despite, you know, COVID cases still high, I did notice traffic is back in town. People are out and about again in the malls and in restaurants. So a little bit of, I think people getting used to it, but I do notice most people are behaving themselves. They are keeping the necessary social distancing. And of course, everyone's wearing the mask. I think we are learning to live with this virus, which is positive.
All right. That's a good thing. It's been a very busy weekend for a lot of political parties in the sense that we saw UMNO concluding their General Assembly. We also saw DAP having their Congress. Is it a Congress or is it more like party elections? I'm not sure what the exact terminology is for them. But they did appoint a new leadership.
Yeah, 30 of them. I would say 30 top leaders that were and in turn then elect the top leaders within DAP, right? I think that's how the system works. So yeah, lots of political news, which we will be covering later today, I believe.
That's right. We have a couple of things lined up for you this morning. So in keeping with this whole discussion of what the new normal looks like, at 7:15, we're going to be reviewing the progress of the COVID-19 vaccination program for children, also known as PIC Kids. We're going to have consultant pediatrician Datuk Dr. Musa Nordin on the line with us.
And then at 7:30, we'll speak to economist Bernard Orr with Coface to better understand the economic crisis in Sri Lanka.
I think a lot of headlines coming out of Sri Lanka in last terms week. Of just the dire situation that they're in. I hadn't realized actually how
vulnerable much, they were are to
how
the economic crisis.
Struggling, yes, in the pandemic recovery.
And this is not the first time because I remember in 2008 when I visited the island, it was also during the time when oil prices were very, very high. And yes, there is a negative impact. They are also very dependent on remittances, tourism. And it's interesting because they actually have a large diaspora around the world, be it Malaysia, Canada. So people keep an eye on this beautiful island, by the way.
We'll be covering that. And of course, as mentioned, we are going to cover the outcome of the 2021 General Assembly. We'll summarize the key takeaways with political analyst Adip Zalkapli of Bauer Group Asia at 7:45. And then after that, at 8:30, we're going to hear from the UMNO Youth Chief, Datuk Dr. Ashraf Wajdi Dusuki, on the state of unity within the party. We'll have all this and more today on The Morning Run. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. That was Still Corners with The Trip. A trippy tune indeed. What a great way to start the Monday. 21st of March here, 6:08 in the morning. I'm Shazana Mokhtar with Wong Xiaoning and Tan Chun Lee. Now, we are beginning our first story of the morning about a op-ed piece in the Financial Times titled The Strange Death of the Salutation. Chun Lee, why don't you walk us through this story? What is this about?
This is about email etiquette, which we want to talk about a little bit this morning. Do you often start an email by jumping straight into the subject and skipping the salutation? I don't know about you guys, but I try not to, unless it's someone that I'm really close to or this is like a subsequent email or something. So apparently, the Financial Times article by Pelita Clark observed that there has been a rise of emails with no salutation, and she thinks it's unwise to do so.
I think that the rise of emails with no salutations corresponds with the rise of public online forums. Because you know how like in Reddit or like laoyat.com, you know how a forum where people just kind of comment, or even the comment sections of articles, for example, you don't start your comment with a dear writer. You kind of just go straight into giving your opinion, right? So perhaps that's maybe migrated also to emails where you feel like when you're responding to a writer, you just, you know, write in whatever you think without thinking about that salutation. That's my theory.
I have a little bit of a different theory in the sense that what I notice is that people seem to, and this is just an observation of mine, and I'm guilty of it because I like to write very short emails, right to the point, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm out of there, okay? Because I think people have no time to read, or, you know, a long email. But I think what has changed a lot is that there's a blurring of lines between what is like casual conversation, formal conversation, business conversation, and there's no distinction anymore. For me, after a while, people have forgotten it, and I think that's a skill that perhaps that we have to relearn. So I'm not saying that there's only one way to write an email. There are many ways to write an email, But perhaps what's important is who is that email addressed to and what is your intention?
You know how back in school, a long time ago when we were all in school, we used to learn...
like very, very long
time.
For me, especially.
We were back in the time when people still sent letters or faxed letters, you know. So you had the formal letter and the informal letter. So we were taught to write in that way, right? And when email came in, it was seen as... I think it kind of blurred it, right? Yeah, it straddled the two.
Mm.
So it took some time to sort of build what kind of rules or guidelines for writing formal or informal letters via email. And I think, you know, we're still kind of grappling with that balance.
And that balance has some, I wouldn't use the word deteriorate, but it's gone even further because now the blurring of lines is between emails and, let's say, your WhatsApp messages, right?
Mm, very true.
So it's gone even further down the road. And now with the WhatsApp messages, of which I'm extremely guilty of, and you all know that, sometimes I don't even bother to write any words. I send you a sticker that sums up my emotions, what I feel, right? And that sticker says it all, right? Whether it's, you know, my favorite is given to me by one of our producers, Mo, which is a picture of a woman throwing a slipper across the room. And that's usually because I'm annoyed or I think it's, what is going on, you know? So the lines become even... blurred. But I think we must still always take note of who are we communicating with and what's the intention of that communication.
But I have to say you have quite a lot of a collection of cute stickers.
Of course. It's one of my joys in life. I don't send it to everybody. I only really send it to my friends, for sure. And even to friends which I think like it, because some friends of mine are like, why are you so juvenile? I'm like, okay, don't be such an adult. But never mind, I won't send you anymore. So I guess it's just different ways of communicating.
Yeah, and when I talk about salutation, right, is it rude to say, hey, or hi?
It depends who the hey and hi is, right?
Yeah,
so if you're writing to the government department, for example, and the example they give in the FT is the tax department, I think a hey and hi doesn't really quite work. I think you need to put like dear Puan or dear Inche, you know, and
hey,
who is it?
Hey, LHDN.
Give me back my money. I don't think that kind of works, right? So really, who is the email to? What is the purpose? Ask yourself those questions before you start typing, right? And do a bit of research because you want to know who is this email addressed to? And I think that's when maybe the letter suggests it's a little bit confusing when you're not really sure. Like you've done your research and she gave some interesting suggestions like dear marketing team or something like that. If you're uncertain, who is the audience?
Yeah. I think it's important. Yeah, as you said, I agree. The rule of thumb is always keep in mind who you're writing to. If you're writing to an organization and you're not sure who it is, I think it's best to have a kind of a generic salutation of sorts. But it's always better to have that direction rather than just sending an email out into the void.
Yeah, I was taught a long time ago that someone told me writing dear is more formal than hey and hi-la. So I'm not sure if this is still the case because, you know, it seems to be very conservative to be like, dear.
You can't go wrong with the dear, by the way. You can never go wrong with the dear.
And I guess it always depends on whether this is in the UK or in the US or in Malaysia. I feel like every country has their own unique, you know, anachronisms to this. So take context into account when you're writing your emails. But, you know, tell us what you think. Do you use salutations for your emails or what's your preferred method of salutation? And what other email etiquette rules do you think are often broken? You know, what do you think needs to be tightened? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. It's 6:14 in the morning. We're taking a quick break. And when we come back, we imagine what an effective immigration policy would look like for Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. That was Heroes by David Bowie. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar with Wong Xiaoning and Tan Chen Li. 6:19 in the morning on Monday, the 21st of March. Good morning, everyone. We were earlier talking about email etiquette, and we actually have a WhatsApp message from Stephen Ho. He's weighing in on his experience in email etiquette. What did he say, Xiaoning?
I'm Gen Z, and when I entered the workforce, I did start my emails with a hi only, but got sounded up by the boss. So now he starts with, dear so-and-so, how are you? Hope you're doing well in this pandemic time. And he ends with, stay healthy, stay safe, which I kind of like. I like the way he ends, actually. It's really relevant today.
And he said, I don't sincerely mean it when asking, but it's just there as a placeholder.
Okay, you didn't have to confess to that, Stephen.
Yes.
But niceties like that do count in helping to convey a very pleasant tone in the email. So kudos to that. I think that's a good practice, a good habit to do for your emails. Tell us what you think. What kind of email etiquette do you use in writing your emails? WhatsApp us at 01-878-9899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We're turning our attention to another opinion piece in the Financial Times, this one penned by Stephen Bush, and he discussed the challenges of crafting immigration policy. I think this is an issue that's really come to the forefront, especially with so many countries seeing slowing population growth, you know. Mm. The next option to grow the labor force is really going to be through immigration. And we are seeing this issue come to the forefront amid the war in Ukraine and the influx of refugees to European countries. So Stephen Bush was writing in the context of the UK immigration network. But I was thinking that we could also extrapolate this to a discussion about Malaysia's immigration policy and whether we have the right rules in place to, you know, attract the right talent.
From what I know, it's not easy to come to Malaysia to live and work other than the MM2H program. But that also, there are some new guidelines, although they have sort of revived it a little bit. That's what I know. I've seen a lot of my friend's spouse who have a difficult time trying to settle here with their partners, Malaysian partners, because of these strict immigration rules in Malaysia.
So, well, in the first place, right, we are well known for not even giving citizenship to women. To children born of Malaysian mothers, unless they so happen to be born in this country. But that same rule doesn't apply to men. So I'm not surprised that we have rather strict immigration rules.
We have a very clear imbalance in the conferring of citizenship between Malaysian mothers and fathers, which is currently making its way through the courts at this moment, something that we're all watching eagerly.
Although I think the Home Ministry did issue some citizens' certificates, but it was just a handful of kids?
They did, and they have not withdrawn their case in the courts. So they are appealing the decision to allow Malaysian mothers to confer citizenship to children born abroad. Mm. They've actually appealed that, even though the public is asking them, you don't need to appeal this. You can let this go.
But yeah, this is 2022, right? What about equal rights?
In any case, it's making its way through the courts. And I think one of the things about immigration policy that maybe gets overlooked, people look at it as a policy to allow foreigners to come in or out. But it's more than just that, because your immigration policy is also going to be interlinked to other policies, such as your healthcare policy, such as your housing policy, such as your education policy. Do you have the setup to be able to accommodate more people coming in? So it's a big jigsaw puzzle piece, and you can't look at one without the other in a way. And that's something that is being considered in the countries where they're seeing a lot of influx of Ukrainian refugees, and the refugees are settling down and they're, you know, allowed to enter school. And people are asking these kinds of questions. How do we build up the capacity to be able to care for the people coming in as well as the existing local population?
I'm also thinking about the point-based system. I know that a lot of countries do have a point-based system. I think even Singapore has recently changed their immigration, also called the employment pass requirement, that have, I think they're trying to extract the super skill, right? And then they have all these point-based system. I wonder if Malaysia could consider something like that as well, since we have a population that seems to be aging already, right? We will at some point need to have some influx of, or some immigration of workers, or super skill in a way, right, to also up our level of skill within our country.
Stephen Bush did talk about the point system in his article. Mm. And he said that these point systems, they do have a flaw, because ultimately it's the government that sort of decides what kind of workers they want to come in and out. And that may not necessarily tally with what industry or what the economic sectors need. So he actually proposed in his article that businesses should be given the authority to issue visas and to conduct the hiring process on their own, because they know who they need and who they want.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There is, I suppose, some logic in giving that leeway, although I don't know if there's any country that actually gives that freedom to the private sector. Yeah.
Well, I think in some ways, Malaysia tried to encourage IT talent. At one point, I'm not sure whether we still practice it. We did make it easier for certain sectors to hire, especially if it's related to technology, because that was something that we were really pushing for. I'm not sure whether that visa scheme still exists. But what is interesting is Stevens Bush point in that governments should just go back to being governments, right? So that's their job is not necessarily to craft what companies need, but I'm not in total agreement with them, with him, because I think that the government does need to take a position and they need to be forward-looking. Well, organizations are current, right? This is their shortfall at the moment. They need these people with certain skill sets, XYZ, now. So they offer these visas, hypothetically, if let's say we use his approach. But governments need to plan for this 10, 20, 30-year kind of horizon. So sometimes you do need governments to actually take a more proactive role and say, okay, in 10, 20 years, we expect our economy to be more driven by, let's say, technology, Internet of Things, 5G, and we hire accordingly in that way. So it may be a blend.
Tell us what you think. You know, what needs to be in Malaysia's immigration policy to make it truly effective? You can WhatsApp us at 01-8789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. 6:25 in the morning, we're heading into the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin. And when we come back, we'll look at headlines from around the world. Taking you to the news is Brian Adams with Somebody, BFM 89.9. That was Marlena Shaw with California Soul. Well, we're all Kuala Lumpurians. No. What do you call ourselves? KLites. We all have a KLite soul. It's 6:39 in the morning on Monday, the 21st of March. I'm Shazana Mokhtar together with Wong Xiaoning and Tan Chen Li. We're the morning run. Well, keeping you company all the way through 10 a.m. today. And it's that time of morning where we take a look at what's been making headlines around the world over the weekend and overnight. Who'd like to start us off with what's caught their eye?
Maybe I'll start with a relative cute news from South Korea. The new president-elect, he plans to move his office from the Imperial Blue House to somewhere in the central Seoul. He thinks this will better communicate with the people there. But of course, there's also a belief that people think that it's linked to belief in shamanistic spiritual practices. So apparently, he's not the first president to try to move or relocate out of the Imperial Blue House, because it's been believed that that place have bad luck, because a lot of the presidents in the past have been given impeachment, corruption trials, or imprisonment. So
maybe they should just stop doing bad stuff. You know,
I think so.
Rather
too.
Than move house. I mean, if you don't commit crimes, then you don't go to jail.
That is so interesting, because when I saw the headline, it said that they wanted to move out of the presidential office or the Blue House to the defense ministry. And I thought that it had something to do with security, you know, like maybe they wanted to do their stance of, I don't know, tougher on military measures or whatnot.
Because of North Korea.
It's bad luck.
By the way, guys, it's alleged, right? It's all alleged. We don't know for sure what the real reasons, right? He officially is because I want to be closer to the people.
Yeah. What we do know is that this step could cost $40 million, which is a pretty huge move I'm wondering, in this economy, is this really what you want to be doing? But in any case, I think all eyes are going to be on South Korea and their new government, especially with rumblings over from North Korea and whether they're stepping up their nuclear program. So I think this region is definitely one to watch in terms of tensions of that nature. What about you, Xiaoning? What has caught your eye this morning?
Okay, we will probably end up with Ukraine, but before we take a little bit of a detour, let's talk about Myanmar. So there are two pieces of news coming out, one of which is the Biden administration intends to declare that Myanmar's years-long repression of the Rohingya Muslim population is going to be called a genocide. And U.S. officials say that Secretary of State Antony Blinken plans to do so at the event at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum on Monday. Now, what is the consequences of it? Well, the designation does not and in itself portend drastic new measures against Myanmar's military-led government, which I think has already been hit by multiple layers of U.S. sanctions, but could just lead to additional pressure on the government, which is already facing accusations of genocide at the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
So it's a very noteworthy development. I think the issue, the label of genocide is very loaded, yeah. Mm. And it's a decision that I feel no country should do lightly. But we've been following the situation in Myanmar for years now, and I think there are many arguments in favor of that characterization.
So the second piece of news is that the Cambodian foreign minister intends to travel to the capital of Myanmar, Naypyidaw. Is that how I pronounce it?
Naypyidaw,
sorry, sir. Completely butchered that word, right? On his maiden visit as ASEAN special envoy to help resolve the political crisis there. So it's a 3-day visit. But I'm like, since when did he become ASEAN's special envoy, the Cambodian foreign minister?
I suppose this was something that took place after Cambodia took the chairmanship of ASEAN for the year. So I think they have been reshuffling who their representatives are. There was a concern, remember, when Cambodia took over, whether they would be a bit soft on the military junta in Myanmar. So I think, yeah, there's still... ASEAN has been seen as quite, not inactive, but they just haven't been effective in trying to get the military junta to soften their stance or step back from what they're doing in the country at the moment. Related to Myanmar, I think there was another headline in the Financial Times over the weekend that Telenor, the Norwegian telecoms company, is divesting from Myanmar. They are selling off their stake in the country to a Lebanese investment group. And this is done, it's some relief to state-controlled Telenor. Telenor is owned by the Norwegian government in some way.
They would have definitely have some shares.
But
I'm as a Norwegian company, I'm not surprised because they probably have some very strong ESG principles that they have to abide with.
That's right. So I feel that it is a loss on both sides, I suppose, in a way, because you would think that when these companies invest in countries like Myanmar or other developing countries, there is like a transfer of technology, a transfer of principles of sorts, but this it didn't come out this way in this end.
No, not at all. So let's shift back to Ukraine, right? Because that's, of course, the hot topic. So there is fierce fighting. It has engulfed the city of Mariupol. And I think Russia has just demanded that Ukraine surrender the city. Although at the same time, Turkey has kind of weighed into this fight and says that Moscow and Kiev are close to an agreement on key points. So I don't know whether we're inching. On one hand, there's a lot of fierce fighting. And on the other hand, there are some form of talks. But whether the talks come fast enough, and what does this mean that Russia will continue to bombard this city, which apparently has been facing the brunt of the Russian onslaught at the moment.
And we have seen institutions like the theatre that was housing people. But the schools have also been struck. I mean, I think the devastation is just, it's heartbreaking. And the talk of how will parties be held accountable, I think, is also ongoing. This is a situation that's not happy for anybody. It's going to take years for Ukraine to rebuild from this if or when the war finally ends. It is 6:45 in the morning. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at what's making headlines in the local newspapers and portals. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. That commotion was by the Creedence Clearwater Revival. The song is called Commotion. You're listening to The Morning Run, 6:49 in the morning. We're all about commotion here.
Did the song wake you up? I certainly hope so if you're listening at home.
I'm Shazana Mokhtar together with Wong Xiaoning and Tan Chen Li. It's that time of day where we take a look at what's making headlines in our local newspapers and portals. What do you have in front of you, Chen Li?
Let's start with the lighter news, which is not so heavy with politics and all that, but it's also related to politics because over the weekend, our Prime Minister announced that we're going to implement, or he wants to propose to the Cabinet, the implementation of 1,500 ringgit minimum wage. But on the Star today, I've seen on page 4, a lot of bosses have actually asked for a slow and steady rise instead, a gradual increase of 25% rather than an abrupt 25% on May 1st.
Okay, I want to know these bosses. Be upfront with your staff, right? If you want it not to happen immediately, you tell your staff, and this is where the crunch time comes, right? I'm curious, how much are wages as a component of your cost? And if you can justify, seriously, that it's a large component, maybe. But so far, I noticed no bosses actually really say what is the percentage of their costs as, you know, this 25%. How much is it going to really crimp margins, right? So 1,500 in Malaysia isn't very much, actually.
And actually, some businesses have asked to be exempted from this implementation, which the ministry said they're going to deliberate on the postponement of the implementation, and also for some sectors, especially the micro, small and medium enterprises. They might do an exclusion here.
I mean, when Prime Minister Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri announced this during the UMNO General Assembly over the weekend,
a rather odd forum to make such an announcement, right?
I felt so. But he did put some qualifications to this. He did put some caveats. He said this would apply to companies with more than 5 persons, but that there will be carve-outs of some sort to take into account SMEs and stuff. So again, implementation of this is still very hazy. We're all waiting for more details on whether this will actually be pushed forward. Also to say that employers have always protested against the minimum wage. It's been 10 years since the argument of minimum wage came forward. They will always say, we need more time. We need more breathing space. So not surprised that they're pushing back on this. In other news, turning our attention to, I guess, politics, because DAP held their party elections yesterday. And they have a new Secretary General now. Mm. It is Anthony Lok, the Seremban MP. He's taken over from Lim Guan Eng, who has stepped down from the Secretary General
post. Has to step down. And she had to, right, under the ROS rules,
that
believe.
Is right. It's a three-term limit. Mm. So he served that and he's stepping down according to their constitution.
Now, another famous politician that is finally stepping down, he's going to retire, is Lim Kit Siang, right? He has said that he's not going to run for any more elections going forward. This will be his last term. Well, he's contributed a lot to DAP. I think he's been arrested twice under ISA. He's made a lot of sacrifices. But it's also interesting to note that he's kind of saying, okay, I give way. I give way to the younger generation. So the 30 people, DAP members that were elected to, I would say, their main leadership body is an interesting group of faces, some old, some new. So, you know, let's see what difference they're going to make to the party, especially when the current coalition seems to be in a bit of a disarray.
Exactly. DAP is the biggest party among the Pakatan Harapan coalition at the moment.
With the most seats in among the Pakatan Harapan coalition.
Which is a testament to just the political force that they've been building up over the years, that they've managed to achieve that. Where they'll go forward, like you said, I think it's a big question mark how coalition politics will evolve.
Yeah, and related to this is actually news that the anti-party hopping bill might be postponed. This is according to the Malaysia Reserve page 7. So the minister in the PM's department, Dato' Sri Wan Junaidi Tunku Jaafar, said that according to him, the cabinet has decided that the bill still requires further deliberation through engagement sessions with other stakeholders, particularly the BN and PN, to ensure amendments get their support in Dewan Rakyat.
Interesting developments indeed, because if we recall, this anti-hopping bill was one of the conditions of the MOU between the government and Pakatan Harapan.
Which is supposed to last till July, right? The MOU?
End of July, correct. This was one of the deliverables. And I believe there were headlines over the weekend as well of Lim Guan Eng saying if this anti-hopping bill isn't delivered within the timeline that's stipulated, then the MOU is off. Mm. So what does this mean for detente, this very precarious truce that's been held between the two sides?
I only have like two alphabets in my head floating around, right? One is a G, one is a E, and it's followed by two numbers, which is 1 and 5. Does this mean that GE15 is going to come sooner than later? Well, a lot of speculation on that on the back of the recently concluded UMNO meeting over the weekend.
That's right. I mean, I think there was a lot of expectation that the UMNO General Assembly would come out with a resolution to say that they want to call for snap elections. But this didn't materialize. And in fact, the Prime Minister said that this decision will be deliberated among the top 5 leaders of UMNO to determine when the right date should be.
And we're going to be talking about this later on at 7:45 and again at 8:30. So do tune in if you really want to have that little bit of conversation about UMNO.
It's 6:55 in the morning. We're going to head into the 7 a.m. news bulletin. And then after that, we'll take a look at how global markets ended the trading week on Friday. Taking you to the news is Learn to Fly by the Foo Fighters, BFM 89.9.